In your book, there is a chapter entitled Memory Wars. And in that chapter, you write about how Kennedy's legacy would be shaped, ultimately boiled down to who owned his image. Right. You write in relation to the Kennedy family's role in managing the ideological thrust of the Kennedy Library that Jacqueline Kennedy and her family became active participants, as you say, in the long struggle over who owned the president's historical identity, and that this struggle reveals, again, one of the major themes that runs throughout this narrative, the tension between history and memory, between what is recalled and what is forgotten, between the historical profession and the heritage industry. You touched briefly on the sort of question of the historiography of Kennedy's life and legacy. What place within Kennedy historiography do you see your book, The Afterlife of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, occupying?
That's a good one. If I had to take a position on it, I would call myself among the post-revisionists who try to achieve a kind of a balanced point of view. They don't ignore the shortcomings of Kennedy's character and his policies. I'm prepared to admit that he moved slower than a lot of people wanted him to move when it came to the civil rights. But I also believe that when he finally did take action, he stepped forward. His action was decisive, and he did step forward with a piece of legislation passed after his death that was really the most progressive and even radical piece of civil rights legislation since the Civil War. I agree that he did increase the number of American military advisors in Vietnam. But at the same time, he said repeatedly, not only that he didn't want to abandon Vietnam, but he also said repeatedly that he did not want to have Americans involved in a ground war in Vietnam. And toward the end of his life, there are several occasions in which he talked to others about pulling the plug on American involvement in Vietnam, that it was the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, it was their struggle, not the American struggle. And if things didn't improve by the time the next election was over, he was prepared to find reason to pull the plug and withdraw American forces. So, and I could give other examples. For example, the missile crisis. It's probably true, I think, that Kennedy helped provoke the missile crisis because not only with the Bay of Pigs, which was a fiasco, but because after the Bay of Pigs, there were several American assassination plots against Castro and other efforts to economically and politically destabilize Castro. And under the circumstances, it's probably true that Castro felt he had very little choice but to turn to the Soviet Union for military assistance and protection, as well as economic aid against the Americans. So in that sense, you can make the case that he brought on the missile crisis. That being said, and I think it's all true, it's also true that when the crisis came, he behaved in some ways like the only adult in the room. I mean, he was surrounded by hardline hawks and in Congress as well, who were quite prepared, he thought, to risk a nuclear war or a Soviet attack on Berlin, much more important than Cuba, to American security interests. And so he found an alternative way to de-escalate that crisis and resolve the war, and I think he deserves some credit for that. So in all these ways, I think, Jennifer, that I take a post-revisionist view that kind of balanced between the good and the bad. But most importantly, I think I've come in this book to appreciate the circumstances or the context in which he served as president.